often when people talk about faith and reason, the question is, you know, are they compatible? Can you have both faith and reason? And I'm starting this lecture from the opposite point of view. Faith and reason are so interconnected and so interdependent. Is there even a distinction between the two? Isn't faith, at least in a Catholic way of thinking about it, just reason, right? Apply it to God and to things of salvation. Is there anything that really distinguishes between the two? So I'm going to start from that perspective, that question anyway. And yeah, let's go ahead and look at the next slide. I'm going to draw mostly on St. Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologia, or Summa Theologica, which is, I apologize, this is real elementary for some of you, but I just want to start from the ground floor up, so to speak. This is a work that Aquinas wrote over a 10-year period, near the end of his life. And it's a summary, in Latin means a summary of theology. And it was really designed as a kind of theology 101 course, but it's a huge 101 course, 101, 102, 103, and so on. It's a pretty extensive course, but it tries to start right from the beginning. I was teaching in Rome and at the University of Paris. There are three parts to it, and there are 614 questions, which are something like topics, really. They're not questions in our sense. The articles are actually the questions, so it's a little confusing. So each article starts with a question, as in this lecture, right? Is there a distinction between faith and reason? That would be a typical kind of question for an article. There's actually an article for this in Aquinas, so I'm adding to the Summa here, but drawing on other parts of the Summa, as you might have done. Altogether, there's 3,125 articles, so it's quite a bit, and some of the articles are fairly long, some of them are short, usually a page, two, three pages, so it's a substantial work, and covers God, the creation, human nature, psychology, ethics, basic principles of theology, Trinity, moral theology, virtues, and natural law, and the end times. So it covers pretty comprehensively the questions that you want to answer. He was an Italian Dominican friar, a theologian, philosopher, saint, and later declared a doctor of the church, one of the few doctors. So yeah, Sam, let's go to the next one. So here's what a typical article of the Summa looks like. So one of the things I wanted to do in this talk was to walk you through what an article looks like so that if you were to just pick up, or actually nowadays, click on the Summa on your screen, you'd sort of understand what's going on in a typical article. So, first of all, a yes-no question is asked, just as I did today. Is there a distinction between faith and reason? Right? Yes or no. Then you get a series of what are called objections. Right? And these objections are pretty plausible, reasonable arguments in support of the wrong answer to the question, right? Or at least the weaker of the two answers to the questions, the least right question to answer to the question. And these are written, these are numbered, 1, 2, 3. They're written from the point of view of Aquinas trying to find the very best arguments on the other side of the issue that he can, and to state them as clearly and as sympathetically as he possibly can. So I find when first time I've taught the Summa, I've had students read some of it. And they're reading the part one, question two, article three, and about the existence of God, and they came right thinking, Aquinas is an atheist. He lays out all these really powerful objections, and they're very persuasively stated, right? I didn't realize that. You know, I thought he was some kind of a, you know, Christian or something. But of course, said, well, wait a minute. You have to read the whole article, right? Don't just should focus on the objections. Well, yeah, in that particular example, in the existence of God, he does lay out the three strongest arguments against God's existence and states them very clearly and persuasively and effectively, and as he does it in every case. I mean, one of the great things about Aquinas actually is his attempt always to try to understand everyone, including those who are wrong, and to draw out what's right in them, and then, of course, ultimately to correct them and to bring them around to the truth. But I think it's very important to get that first step right. Right? Something we can learn about in these days of Twitter wars and so on, where we don't take that effort to try to understand the other person and what they're trying to say. And Aquinas is such a great model of that. But now the objections are something that is called the sed contra. So that's but to the contrary. But no, right? And then, this is usually a fairly short section where Aquinas just cites some authority in the theology. This is a work of theology. So So it might be the Bible, it might be Augustine or some other church father saying, no, that those answers were wrong. It's no rather than yes, or yes rather than no. The respondeo, I answer. And this is the most important part of the article. This is where Aquinas gives the answer and lays out what he thinks are the best arguments in support of his position. And then finally, there are the replies. And the replies match up to the objections one-to-one. So if there were four objections, there are four replies. Seven objections, seven replies. Reply one, response to objection one, and so on. So it's very systematically organized. Makes it a little bit tricky to read. You have to jump around in the text a bit, and I'll be able to use PowerPoint to jump us around more quickly today in my sort of made-up little article today. And so again, what Aquinas does is, in these replies, he goes as quickly as possible to the fundamental mistake in each objection, and then points out what's wrong with it, so that you're able then to go back to objections and say, oh yeah, those were wrong. Right? So is there a distinction between faith and reason? So just like Aquinas' article, I'm going to give some objections that say, no, there's no objection. There's no distinction between faith and reason. They're actually the same thing. So you now know what I'm going to say right in the end, right? So the objection is going to say, no. But I'm going to try and find seven objections that I think are the most reasonable, most plausible objections you can find for this wrong answer to this article. So first of all, I'm going to draw on one of my favorite authors, actually, G.K. Chesterton, who was a Catholic a convert like myself, and a literary figure and an apologist, and I know he's hard to classify, right? He was just Chesterton. Wrote about 100, somewhere between 90 and 110 years ago today. So this first objection, I say, there's no distinction between faith and reason because to accept the deliverances of reason is already a matter of faith. So Chesterton writes, it's a matter of faith to believe that our thoughts have any relation to reality. So before you can reason at all, you've got to believe that your reason would get you to the truth. It has some sort of connection to reality. It's only through faith, in fact, in the benevolence and wisdom of God that we have any confidence in our natural cognitive faculties, right? Wow, as Chesterton puts it, if there's no God, if we just evolved by blind evolution, then all our thought are just motions in the brain of a bewildered ape. That is, you know, there's just stuff going on in our brain that would have no correlation to reality. It wouldn't be guiding us to any truth. So the only reason that we can believe that by thinking, and you're doing philosophy carefully, and doing scientific investigation, the only reason we can believe that leads us to the truth is because we think that our minds have been designed by God, who was himself wise and benevolent, and built us in such a way that we get to the truth. But that's a matter of faith, to believe that we were so created. So, in fact, reason is just an application of faith, right? Rather than the other way around. You have to have this kind of Chestertonian faith in order to reason, so therefore there's no real distinction between the two. Let's go on to the next objection. We'll come back to this later. Now, faith is typically defined, as we'll see, as accepting certain truths on the basis of the fact that God has revealed them to us. Since faith trusts in God's veracity, right? So we trust that God is truthful, and he tells us certain things, and so we believe them on the basis of God's say-so. Right? Now reason, human reason, as we'll see, can demonstrate that God exists, Summa Theologia, again, part one, question two, article three, that God is perfectly innocent in all of his actions, he wouldn't deceive us, and that he's perfect in knowledge, right? So if he exists, perfect in knowledge, he wouldn't deceive us, and it's going to follow that everything he says is going to be true. There's a little syllogism we could apply. So a syllogism is a little bit of deductive reasoning, right? God is perfectly good and omniscient. Whatever a perfectly good and omniscient, all-knowing being asserts to us is true. Therefore, whatever God asserts is true. So an act of faith is just an application of that bit of reasoning, a little syllogism. So there's no distinction, again, between faith and reason. Third objection. It's an act of reason to accept the testimony of any reliable witness and to believe what they say is true. Right? So if I'm a reliable witness about what Thomas Aquinas says on some subject, and it's reasonable for you, it's an exercise of reason for you to believe me when I say so. But faith, is just a matter of accepting the witness and authority of God, who's self-evidently reliable, So faith is just an exercise of human reason. There's nothing, nothing contrary, nothing even beyond reason in believing what God says, because he's a reliable witness to whatever he reveals to us, right? So it's a no-brainer, nothing beyond reason there. All right, objection four. Now, faith further accepts the teachings of the scriptures and of the church as true because it accepts that they are what God himself teaches. So this qualifies what we just said a bit, right? Because, of course, it's reasonable to believe whatever God says, but how do we know that the Catholic faith is what God has told us? How do we know that it is divine testimony? But we recognize the divine character of the scriptures and of the church on the basis of good and compelling evidence, namely the occurrence of miracles and the fulfillment of prophecy by Jesus. As Thomas writes, the believer has sufficient motive for believing, for he is moved by authority of divine teaching confirmed by miracles. This is in the Summa Part 2.2. And he also quotes Hebrews 7, or cites it. He said, God also bearing them witness of signs, miracles, and diverse signs and wonders and diverse miracles and distributions of the Spirit. But let's move on to the next slide. It's the province of reason to accept truths on the basis of good and compelling evidence. So we have good and compelling evidence that God is speaking to us through the church and through the scriptures. Reason responds to that good and compelling evidence and believes that it is God so speaking. Again, there's no difference. Faith just is reason, just an application of reason in this particular case. All right, objection five. Faith can exist in the absence of the grace of charity, because there's such a thing, according to Aquinas, as dead faith. So dead faith is a faith that exists in someone who's lost the gift of charity. So they've lost that supernatural gift that enables them to love God, but nonetheless, they still have faith. Whatever can exist without the grace of charity is not really a supernatural virtue, since charity, love of God, is the form of supernatural virtue, according to Aquinas, in a couple passages in Summa Theologia. Now, form here is a real important concept for Aquinas, because the form of something is what makes it what it is. So the reason I'm a human being is I have a human form that makes me human. The reason that gold is golden is because it has a form of gold that makes it golden. So charity is the form of supernatural virtue. You take away the form of supernatural virtue, you don't have a supernatural virtue anymore. Right? And so faith would not be a supernatural virtue. But if faith is not a supernatural virtue, then it's merely a natural disposition to accept certain truths. But every natural disposition to truth is comprised by the human faculty of reason. So if it's not supernatural, it's natural. If it's natural, it's reason. So therefore, again, faith is just a disposition of human reason towards particular truths. There's no distinction between faith and reason. So next one. Objection six. Every disposition in the human being is either from nature or from grace. So either we're disposed to do something by nature, by the way God created us, or by grace, this thing that he adds to us for Christ's sake to enable us to do supernatural things. But faith cannot be from grace, since faith precedes the reception of grace. Hebrews 11:6 says, he that comes to God must believe that he is. So first you have to have faith before you can come to God. And the Council of Trent says that faith is the root of justification. So faith has to be there before grace can arrive in order to be the root of that justification. So faith would be of nature, not of grace. But if faith is of nature, then it's a natural disposition of the human intellect, but that's just the name for that is just reason. So again, faith is just a particular instance of human reason. Objection seven, last objection. Faith and reason cannot be in conflict with each other, since they're both gifts of God, and God's purposes can't be discordant. So God gives us faith, God gives us reason, so they can't be in conflict with each other. But reason demands that we not be certain of anything that isn't apparent to us. If the truth isn't apparent to us, then it might be false, and reason says don't be certain in the face of possible falsehood. But faith demands that we be certain of what we believe, according to second part, question 4, article 1, and also Hebrews 11:1, which St. Thomas quotes here. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence, or sometimes translated the conviction, the certainty of things not seen. Hence, the things we believe by faith must be apparent to us, because we're certain of them. But whatever is apparent to us is a matter of reason. So faith, again, must simply be an application of human reason to these spiritual things. All All right, so those are the objections. So now we're at the turning point of my article, right? And this is the said contrary, but to the contrary bit. And so here I'm actually going to do something Thomas never does, which is cite himself as the authority, right, for this turn. That would be sort of odd, right, that he doesn't do it, but I can. And so St. Thomas writes, it's evident that neither faith nor opinion can be of things seen either by the senses or by the intellect. And it's impossible for one and the same thing to be an object of science, or knowledge, scientia, and of belief at the same person. So first thing he says is that faith is not the same thing as science, whatever that is. We'll see what that means in a minute. So what is this? If it's not science, it's either opinion or something else. But at the same time, faith is distinguished from rational opinion, since the act of believing cleaves firmly to one side. It has a kind of certainty to it, in contrast to opinion, which inclines to one side with fear of the other. So when I have an opinion, I lean towards one particular position, but I'm afraid that I might be wrong, right? So there's always a measure of uncertainty involved in opinion. So faith can't be knowledge, and it can't be opinion either. And if reason is exhausted by knowledge and opinion, then faith has to be something outside of reason, something beyond knowledge and rational opinion. And second, I'm going to do this is a bit longer said contrary than Aquinas would usually do, but I'll go ahead and cite some more of Aquinas' authority here. Angelic doctor, this is a traditional phrase for Aquinas, and he never calls himself this, of course, but he does use these kinds of nicknames a lot. So he called Aristotle the philosopher, and Ibn Rushd is the commentator, and so on. So we'll call him the angelic doctor. He says that by natural inclination, man is directed to his connatural end. So there's a natural or connatural end, which is sort of earthly happiness, that we are directed to by our natural faculties. This happens in respect of the reason or intellect, insofar as it contains the first principles which are known to us by the natural light of the intellect, and which are reason's starting point. So we have a natural light built into us by nature, and that suffices to get us to our natural end or connatural end, which is earthly happiness. But man needed, in addition to that natural end, Aquinas thinks, says God has given us a supernatural end. He's given us an end of eternal life, of fellowship with God, knowing God as he is, an end that exceeds our nature, supernatural end. And in order to get to that supernatural end, he says, man needed to receive, in addition, something supernatural to direct him to that supernatural end. So we've got just enough gas in us naturally to get us to our natural end, but our supernatural destination is way beyond that. And to get there, God had to give us a supernatural fuel, so to speak. And in respect of the intellect, man receives certain supernatural principles which are held by means of the art of a divine light. These are the articles of faith, which is about which is faith. So there's a light of reason, a light of nature, which is reason. There's a supernatural divine light that gets us to our supernatural end. Okay, so at this point, we've got a bunch of arguments saying that there's no distinction. We've got Aquinas saying there is a distinction, but we haven't yet got any reasons to why there is a distinction. Right? We've just got to get the bald assertion that that's so. So this is where we get into my reply, where I try to argue, try to explain why Aquinas is right about this, why there is a distinction. So faith and reason are certainly distinct. What a person believes, I'll just use that as the verb for faith. What a person believes, he cannot at the same time accept on the basis of reason. For what we accept through reason, we either know in the strict sense, which again is this word scientia. It's where we get the word science from. But for Aquinas, I'll explain a little bit later what it means. But it means a certain kind of natural knowledge with certainty that our intellect gives us. Or we accept with some reservation and with some fear of error, which is what he calls rational opinion. And in some cases, rational opinion approaches the knowledge. In fact, there are other words in Latin for knowledge besides scientia, like notitia, that Aquinas uses, and he even refers to faith as a kind of knowledge under the notitia of faith. So there's a kind of knowledge that we can have that's non-scientific knowledge. In this lecture, I'm going to call it moral knowledge, not in the sense of not immoral, but just moral in the sense of having to do with everyday life, the mores of dealing with everyday life. So in a legal setting, when we decide that someone's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that's not really scientific knowledge of their guilt. but it might count as moral knowledge, would be enough. It's still rational opinion, but it's such powerful, rational opinion with such a powerful basis that it approaches to knowledge in some sense. So just stay on this slide for a bit. What the human mind, so let me just go through these three other categories here one by one real quickly. So what the human mind knows, when the human mind knows something in the strict scientific sense, scientia, it so clearly sees, in a sense, the truth that it's unable not to accept the truth. It's just overwhelmingly obvious. So for example, the principles of arithmetic, right? So once I see that 3 is bigger than 2, or that 2 plus 2 is 4, or something like that, my intellect just automatically leaps to the conclusion, can't really help itself, right? It has to be that 2 plus 2 is 4. And Aquinas thinks this can also happen in the scientific realm. So if I come to really understand what a natural phenomenon is, and then I see that certain things follow from that understanding, he thinks that once again, our intellect will just naturally jump to those conclusions without any kind of doubt. So for instance, if I come to really understand, as I think most of us do nowadays, right, that a solar eclipse is a matter of the moon getting in between the sun and the earth and obscuring the light, right? Then if you tell me that an eclipse is going to occur tomorrow, my mind says that means that tomorrow the moon is going to be between the earth and the sun, it's going to block the light. And again, I can't sort of unthink that, right? My intellect is just going to automatically reach that conclusion. So that's a case of scientific knowledge, scientia. Mere rational opinion is different. So again, if I'm in a court case and I have to decide something is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, there's room for some doubt, but it's not, and there remains some possibility of error. Sorry, I got ahead of myself a bit. So let me give you another example. Suppose that you're researching which college or university is the best one for you to go to, and you look through all the information, right? And you end up inclining towards the opinion that University of Texas is the best choice for you. And that's a reasonable conclusion for you to reach, given the total evidence. But if pressed, right, and I say, but could we possibly be wrong about that? You have to say, well, yeah, actually, there are other good places, right? So, and maybe even for me. So I can see that I've accepted this proposition, I've done sort of reasonably, but there's a real possibility I could be wrong in that kind of case. There's an intermediate case, which I describe as moral knowledge. So this is the case where it's like the rational opinion case, except now the evidence is so strong that it approaches the case of scientific knowledge. It's not quite the same. You can still see that there's a possibility that I could reject this conclusion, right? So, but maybe not reasonably. So again, I'm in the jury. We've got this overwhelming evidence that the person's guilty, all these eyewitnesses, DNA, and so on. And I think, yeah, but I don't think so. I just look at that face and it's so honest, I just don't believe him. I'm gonna vote innocent. So it's not like the 2 plus 2 equals 4, right? It's possible for the intellect, even given this overwhelming evidence, still to go the wrong way. Maybe unreasonably, but still possible, right? And so that's what we might call moral knowledge, if it doesn't go wrong, right? We go with the evidence, and we admit the theoretical possibility of error, but we think that the theoretical possibility is so remote that from a practical point of view, we're not even going to consider it. So I'm going to argue that faith doesn't fall into any of these categories. And so by faith, I'm going to mean what Aquinas meant, which is the acceptance of the tenets of the Christian religion based on the teachings of the scriptures in the church and caused by an infusion of divine grace. So it has to be divine grace that's got to be involved in true faith. So first of all, and then we'll go to the next slide, we can actually know certain things scientifically, according to Aquinas, about God. So we can know that God exists, and indeed that he's holy and truthful, and that he's all-powerful, and that he created the world, and so on. So all of these things are things, and I'll defend that too, if you want to go into it during question and answer. I think we do have scientific knowledge, right? Not like mathematical knowledge, but it's closer to the kind of knowledge you get in astronomy or physics or something like that, that God exists. Aquinas says, teaches this both in the Summa Theologiae and the Summa Contra Gentiles. In the Vatican I's De Verbum, it says, God, the beginning and end of all things, can be known with certainty, from created reality by the light of human reason. So human reason all by itself, given the creation, can know that God exists. De Verbum quotes St. Paul in Romans 1:20, "For the invisible things of God from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made." But nonetheless, believing in the existence and the nature of God in this way does not suffice for faith. Go on to the next slide. Through divine revelation, this is also De Verbum, God chose to show forth and communicate himself and the eternal decisions of his will regarding the salvation of men. So the incarnation of Christ, the crucifixion, the passion, the resurrection, the sacraments, and all of that, revealing of the Trinity. That is, he chose to share with them those divine treasures which totally transcend the understanding of the human mind. So there are certain things that we call it natural theology that we can establish by human reason, that God exists, all-powerful, and created the world. But there are other facts that the Catholic Church teaches us about the Trinity, the Incarnation, and so on, that exceed totally the capacities for human reason. So we can know scientifically that if God revealed something to us, that it would be true. But that God speaks to us through the scriptures, or through the preaching and teachings of the apostles and their successors, that's a matter of faith, not of scientific knowledge. We can't scientifically know that the Catholic Church is God speaking to us. That's a matter of faith. Nor can we know the things that he reveals in the gospel. Now, can the gospel, the truth of the gospel, be a matter of rational opinion? Yes, it can, I think. In fact, it typically is in many cases. To accept that the gospel, the Christian gospel, is probably true on the basis of the historical evidence, that's still not faith. You haven't got faith if you've gotten to just to that level. Faith enables one to hold on to the truth of the gospel with a kind of certainty and fixity that would be characteristic of scientific knowledge, right? Not of the kind that you would get from rational opinion. Someone who holds Christianity to be merely probably true is not yet a believer. Right? Because that person is going to really take seriously the possibility of error. They're going to want to hedge their bets as much as they possibly can. Maybe mix Christianity with other things just to cover all the bets on the table or something like that. And so, go on to the next slide. Yeah, so this reminds us of James 1:6, where one who doubts is double-minded, who wavers like the sea, which is carried back and forth by the wind. So if faith were merely a matter of rational opinion, we would be that double-minded person in James. But nonetheless, this rational opinion is an essential first step towards faith, according to Aquinas. The divine nature of the Holy Scriptures and of the Catholic Church have been well confirmed by historical evidence, by miracles, by prophecy, and so on. Principal among these are the resurrection of Jesus on the first Easter Sunday. But there have been a multitude of other miracles, right up to present day, the Fatima miracles of the sun, and so on. And Jesus fulfilled hundreds of messianic prophecies in the Old Testament, many beyond his own control. His birth in Bethlehem, his appearance before the conquest of Palestine, but the destruction of Jerusalem, and so on. This kind of knowledge of the probable truth of Christianity doesn't actually require you to get an advanced degree in ancient history or to study all of the manuscripts and so on. You can know, I think, or at least have a firm rational opinion that the resurrection occurred just on the basis of the church's own testimony. So every time we go to Mass on Sunday, we're hearing basically a testimony that Jesus rose on that first Easter Sunday. And it's perfectly reasonable to believe that that's true as a matter of rational opinion, just on the basis of the fact that, well, this is a credible witness who has preserved this testimony from the early days, from the eyewitnesses, and carried it on down to us. And so that's perfectly reasonable. Now, if challenged, we can look at the archaeology, we can look at manuscripts and so on, and all of that actually just confirms the fact that this is a credible witness, and indeed there is good reason to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. So let's look again at what Aquinas says about this in the Summa Contra Gentiles. This is an earlier book that he wrote of apologetics. He says, "For these secrets of divine wisdom, these things that God has revealed to us, which the divine wisdom itself, which knows all these things to the full, is deigned to reveal to man, It reveals his own presence as well as the truth of his teaching and inspiration by fitting arguments. And in order to confirm those truths that exceed natural knowledge, the stuff that faith believes, it gives visible manifestation to works that surpass the ability of all nature. Thus there are the wonderful cures of illnesses, there's the raising of the dead, the wonderful alteration of the heavenly bodies, he means the star of Bethlehem there. And what is more wonderful, the inspiration given to human minds so that simple and untutored persons filled with the gift of the Holy Spirit come to possess instantaneously the highest wisdom and the readiest, steadiest eloquence. So the next slide. So De Verbum teaches, for this reason, Jesus perfected revelation by fulfilling it through his whole work of making himself present and manifesting himself through his words and deeds, his signs and wonders, and especially through his death and glorious resurrection from the dead and final sending of the truth. So this abundance of evidence gives us a sufficient sufficient motive, as Aquinas says, for faith. So we're moved by the authority of divine teaching confirmed by miracles, and what is more, by the inward instinct of the divine invitation. Hence, he does not believe lightly. He has not, however, sufficient reason for scientific knowledge, and so he doesn't lose the merit. So there's sufficient evidence to give us a rational basis for believing, but not scientific knowledge. So we need something that fills the gap here between the uncertainty of rational opinion and the certainty of faith in the absence of scientific knowledge, right? And that's where faith comes in. So so this also goes beyond, let's put it this way. Could this evidence ever amount to moral knowledge? Well, I think it probably could. So the apostles had such immediate knowledge of Jesus and of his resurrection that for them it was true beyond a reasonable doubt that he was the Son of God. And you can see this, for instance, in John 20 when Jesus confronts Thomas after the resurrection, right? And Thomas says, "My Lord and my God," and says, you believe because you see, right? But blessed are those who believe and don't see, which are the state of most of us. So moral knowledge, even that kind of moral knowledge, falls short of faith, as I think Judas Iscariot demonstrates. So he had overwhelmingly good evidence to believe that Jesus was the Messiah, and yet failed to believe despite that. So here's a little chart that sort of illustrates that faith is distinct from scientific knowledge, moral knowledge, and mere rational opinion. Right? So in the case of scientific knowledge and faith, in a certain sense, doubt is impossible. So in the case of scientific knowledge, your intellect just sees it's true, you can't disbelieve it. In the case of faith, you have a special gift from God that enables you to believe this thing with certainty. You can't unbelieve it, at least as long as you have that gift. That contrasts it with rational opinion and moral knowledge, right, which doubt is possible. And maybe reasonable if you have merely rational opinion, or maybe unreasonable if you have moral knowledge, but still possible. Whereas with the gift of faith, you can't. Now finally, what about the act of the will? So in the case of scientific knowledge, the will just isn't involved. In this case, the intellect just grips hold of the truth immediately, automatically, without the will involved. In all other cases, there's a choice that's involved, choosing to believe, to form a certain judgment. And so then you might say, well, wait a minute, if the will is involved, how is doubt impossible? And the answer is because of grace, because grace has enabled us to believe in a way that excludes the possibility of doubt in some sense. Okay, so let me just quickly go through the objections and then we'll open up some questions. So objection one, this is again just the same slide about Chesterton. So I really do think there is such a thing as Chestertonian faith that you need to have in order to have reason. But that's not what Aquinas and not what the Catholic Church means by faith in the strict sense, right? So yes, you do have to believe that there's a God who's created us in order to reason. But that's more of a presupposition of reason than a matter of faith as a separate faculty. Okay, objection two. So as I said, we can know scientifically that God exists and that he's truthful. So objection two is right about that. So we can know by reason alone that any revelation from God must be truthful. But we can't know by reason alone that the Catholic faith is a revelation from God. Right? That's something that you can't know scientifically that has to be based on faith. So that's what's wrong with objection two. Objection three, same sort of problem again. we can know scientifically that whatever God teaches is true, but we can't know scientifically that God teaches this, right, that he teaches the Catholic faith. Objection four, we do indeed have good and even compelling evidence that the gospel has been revealed to us, the evidence from miracles and so on. But still this falls short of faith, right, because the believers can still has to accept the truth of the gospel beyond the possibility of doubt. Whereas, no matter how much evidence you have of miracles and so on, it's always possible to disbelieve, despite that, if you don't have the gift of faith. So that's why that falls short as well. Okay, objection five. This one's a bit more complicated. I'm a little bit over my pay grade here, so bear with me if I get this wrong. But dead faith can indeed persist in the believer who's committed a mortal sin and lost the gift of charity. Nonetheless, such a dead faith is still distinct from reason. So it's still not going to be the same thing as scientific knowledge, obviously. But also, I think, isn't really the same thing as moral knowledge or rational opinion, because its origin is different. It still had its origin in this gift of grace, this original gift of charity. And so it just sort of persists in us by kind of inertia, as opposed to having been, you know, sustained by a gift of grace. So it's a habit of God that God has created, and it's still distinct from reason, even though separated from charity, it does lack the quality of supernatural virtue, and therefore has a kind of vulnerability, a fragility that true faith, living faith, doesn't have. Okay, so objection six. So this one is just wrong. Faith does not precede grace. Right? You have to have grace in order to have faith. The first act of faith is an act of free will, but it's an act of free will that's elicited by divine grace, by gift of grace. And it's true that a natural act of rational opinion can precede faith. So I can look at the miracles and I can say, yeah, that's a reasonable thing to believe, but that's not yet faith. Faith goes beyond that to a kind of certainty that only God can give us. So, for instance, here's an analogy, right, that I think is reasonable. Suppose that I come to believe that somebody is the best possible spouse for me, like my wife. And on the basis of that, I commit myself to her in marriage. Now, once so committed, I have a really firm reason never to doubt her truthfulness or faithfulness or something, right? Because to do so would threaten the marriage, right? And so I really care about the marriage. I have a really powerful motive not to doubt her. So our love for God is going to be infinitely greater than our love for any spouse, right? The friendship of God is of greater value than any marriage. So once I've come to the conclusion that the Christian gospel offers me a route to friendship with God that's likely to succeed, more likely to succeed than any other route, then I've got a very powerful motive to be not to doubt that faith, right? To hold on to it as a vehicle towards which I can achieve, realize that my eternal salvation. And then finally, objection seven. So does reason really demand that we remain doubtful about things that aren't apparent to us? And again, the answer is no, I don't think so. And I think my example of the marriage illustrates that, right? The truthfulness of my wife isn't apparent to me in the sense it's impossible for me to doubt it rationally, logically, or naturally. But I have a very powerful motive not to doubt it, right? And there's nothing unreasonable about acting on that motive. And in an even greater truth, greater extent, that's true in our relationship with God. Now, one last point here. So I've talked about how when you have the gift of faith, doubt is in a certain sense impossible. And one might say, well, wait a minute, I've got the gift of faith, and yet I have feelings of doubt all the time, or I have thoughts of doubt running through my mind. And I want to say, well, those aren't doubts, right? I mean, those are temptations to doubt. They aren't doubt. To actually act against the virtue of faith, you would have to embrace some heretical opinion or apostatize from the Catholic faith or something like that. Simply feeling doubts or having doubtful thoughts run through your head, you should just see those as temptations and not as actual doubts, not yet as sins. All right, good. I'll wrap it up there and open up for questions. I believe that was helpful.